Hello and welcome to The Past and Stuff, the history podcast with Ashley Bozian and Tracy Cooper, where we talk about stuff in the news, our pieces of stuff, and stuff in our lives.
Hi, Ashley.
Hi, Tracy. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good, thanks. I just realized that you have composed new intro and outro music and some of our background music, and I forgot to thank you for that. So,
oh, you are so welcome. I'm happy to help.
So, the people don't know you have a background in music as well as history.
Yes. That's right.
Okay. And then the second thing I wanted to say before we kick off is, did you know that monkey has another meaning? It is slang for something.
I don't think this is going to end well, because I feel like it could have many potential meanings, but all right, I'll bite. What is this other meaning of monkey?
Vagina.
No.
I did not believe it either when one of our listeners pointed it out to me. It is a very sort of turn of the 19th century into the 20th century, mostly used in Australia and America. So it's not really that current, I guess. And I don't think it was ever that common in the UK. But I just kind of listened back to our episode from last week, from which I will just point out that Ashley and I are completely innocent, in case it sounded like soft porn, when I was saying, if I was an Egyptian elite lady, I would certainly perfume my monkey.
I mean, I don't think we're like that innocent. I think that's kind of a stretch. I don't know.
It is a stretch, but that we're innocent of knowing that connotation and ridiculously exploiting it for so long. I don't think we could actually have kept that up if we had done it.
Yeah, that one we did not know. That one we are innocent of. In general, I would not say we're innocent. That one, yes.
So let's move into my stuff in the news this week. And this is not such a lighthearted thing. And it was a last minute substitution this morning because something happened yesterday that I just couldn't really let go without comment. It bothered me. It kept me up at night. And I was like, no, I'm going to talk about this. And that's that yesterday, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who is currently second in running for the GOP primary field. So that's the Republicans. So behind former President Donald Trump, was asked for his thoughts on the instruction of middle schoolers about slavery. And in particular, Kit Mayer of CNN asked him about the Florida Department of Education social studies standards for 2023-24 school year, which provides lesson topics for teachers. And the controversial, quote, benchmark clarification instructs teachers that they must tell students that slaves develop skills which, in some instances, could be applied for their personal benefit. So this line about personal benefit is included as part of a broader lesson entitled, quote, examine the various duties and trades performed by slaves, e.g. agricultural work, painting, carpentry, tailoring, domestic service, blacksmithing, transportation. So this is for middle schoolers, so the sort of forcible sex work isn't included, and you know, I'm okay with that for middle schoolers. But I think this is really, really misleading. So Ms. Mayer asked DeSantis for his thoughts on middle school instruction about exactly how slaves develop skills in which some instances could be applied for their personal benefits. And DeSantis said, quote, they're probably going to show that some folks eventually parlayed, you know, being a blacksmith into doing things later in life. But then DeSantis seemed to sort of back away from the specifics of this teaching on the personal benefits of slavery, saying, I didn't do it, I wasn't involved, but that he believed that the curriculum was rooted in whatever is factual. So, I have so many problems with the idea that a man who might end up running our country believes that slavery carried personal benefits. that I hardly know where to begin. So I enumerated them into 10 reasons why children should not be taught that slavery carried personal benefits. So let's start with that later in life part of his comment. I don't know what's going on here. It seems like he may have got forcibly imported Africans somehow confused with the modern disproportionately incarcerated African young men. There is no later in life. Slavery was for life. It wasn't an apprenticeship scheme where unskilled people were taught beneficial skills that they could use to become entrepreneurs. Slaves were chattel, property, and their children were property. So slaves couldn't be part of this story that America likes to tell itself of self-starters. And that seems to be where this later in life parlaying skills into entrepreneurship seems to be going from. Slaves couldn't sort of do the rags to riches things, pulling yourself up by the bootstraps and becoming a self-made man or woman. Their self was owned by someone else. Their labor efforts and life were owned by someone else. I know you know this, Ashley. I'm on my soapbox, so you're just gonna let me have this one.
Do it.
So this
you're
seems to
totally
be,
right.
There seems to be so much bad history going on here. And for one thing, it seems to telescope the slave experience, if telescope is the right word, or shrink it down from a process that lasted over hundreds of years into one slave's life cycle. Maybe that a slave was captured in Africa, brought to the Americas, taught useful skills, and then freed so that they could parlay this skill into personal benefits. So let's throw down some facts, since DeSantis thinks that the curriculum should be rooted in facts. So the average life expectancy for a slave in the United States in 1850 was 22 years of age. So that's half of white people of what it was for white people at the same time. So for most slaves, there simply wasn't a later in life. So number three, the average lifespan of an enslaved African who worked in a colonial sugar or rice plantation in the Americas was just 7 years. So that's 7 years from being landed and bought and then worked to death on a plantation. And then,
wow, that one I didn't know.
And then new slaves were needed, or quote unquote needed. So number four, the loss of life, the loss of African lives begins at the moment of capture in Africa. So experts estimate that for every group of 100 people kidnapped in Africa, only 64 would survive the march to the coast, where they would be held in such appalling conditions that only 57 of that 100 would board the ships. And then the conditions on board the ships were so bad that only 48 out of that 100 would make it to the Americas to be sold as slaves. So when we talk about the numbers of slaves, we nearly have to double it because of the life loss before people get into slave markets in the Americas. So number five, once purchased, enslaved men and women and children were forced into a process called seasoning, which was a brutal work routine with little food or clothing, forced to speak European languages, not their own languages, and to control their emotions. So their work wasn't something like blacksmithing. It was, for the large part, clearing land and cultivating cash crops that were sold not for their personal benefit, but for the personal benefit of their owners. And a very conservative estimate of how many slaves ended up in field work is about 80%, probably higher. So number six, people think slavery is like so far in the past, but the last forcibly imported slave into America died in 1940. So that's the last known survivor of the last U.S. slave ship. And her name was Matilda McCrea. She died 75 years after the abolition of slavery. So the last African-Americans born into slavery in this country died in the late 60s and early 70s, including an activist called Anna Cooper, who was born into slavery in Raleigh, North Carolina, who died in 1964. And this touched me personally. My mum's name is Anne, so she had the same name as my mother, Anne Cooper, before my mum remarried. And also because, you know, slaves often took the last name of their slave owner as well. So number seven. So slavery existed in the United States from 1619, when European colonizers brought Africans to English North Americans in Jamestown, until the passage of the 13th Amendment in the United States Constitution on December the 5th, 1865. Well, except for the fact that the 13th Amendment doesn't actually outlaw the institution of slavery. If you look at the wording, it has an important exception. And it says neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. So yeah, slavery is still a punishment for prisoners, according to the 13th Amendment. And of course, Black Americans are incarcerated at a rate five times that of white Americans. So I'm going to put a link in the notes to the NAACP.
National Association for the Advancement of Colored People.
Yeah. I think Thank you. I was like, You're I welcome. Should have written that down. I was like, I shouldn't use acronyms, and especially if I don't know what they mean. So thank you for that. Yes.
You're welcome.
Yeah, so I'm going to put a link to the show notes on that issue of penal slavery if you want to check that out.
So is that still active? That sorry to interrupt you. Is that still active, that exception of the 13th Amendment?
Yes.
Dear God.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. I'm just going to react for another few hours. Carry on.
Carry on. Yes. I mean, this is why, you know, incarcerated persons can get away with being paid 12 cents an hour and stuff like that.
Well, not to mention the inhuman conditions that they face while incarcerated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So number eight, in terms of world history, I think focusing on slavery in the US and passing it off as some kind of skills course where people graduate and put these skills to use for their personal benefit strips away the context of the transatlantic slave trade. So around 470,000 kidnapped Africans were sent to North America out of a total of 12 million that were exported. So this is really just over 4%. So, and, you know, given that figure, we also have to look at the deaths before sailing the New World, which we said, you know, were about only 48 out of 100 that were captured. So we can estimate maybe that 24 million were captured, even if 12 million made it across to the Americas. So one figure I've seen puts the sub-Saharan population in 1600 at 100 million. So I know I'm not ignorant of the fact that we're talking about a long period of time for that 12 million people to be forcibly exported, or 24 million perhaps captured. But we can roughly see what a large population, percentage of the population this is that was lost to Africa and for the benefit of other places. And we can sort of anticipate then the long-term impact this has had on impoverishing Africa and enriching Europe and the Americas. We just can't understand the world as it is without understanding how it got that way. And sort of fixating on this narrative of some guy who was a slave but then was freed and became a blacksmith is an injustice to these Floridian children's ability to understand the world and its history. Transatlantic slavery was a world history phenomenon, and teaching about it as if it's just a United States thing, but we should teach about it in a way that doesn't make white children feel ashamed, just mistakes the whole past. It's sort of the whole global past doesn't make any sense without that bit. And I'm British, and British made a lot of mistakes and has a lot of things to be ashamed for in their past. And our prominent part, in the transatlantic slave trade and the profits that came from that really spurred Britain's early entrance into industrial development. So there's these global connections that can't really be understood without appreciating the world historical context. And then number nine, I think one of my biggest objections in terms of world history is the assumption that these kidnapped Africans had no skills before they arrived. They had no skills, they had no histories, they had no lives before they were captured. And if we take the blacksmithing example, the earliest evidence for iron smelting is in Africa. Hmm. So the very earliest surviving prehistoric iron artifacts were made from meteoric iron nickel, so that came from meteors, in 4th century millennium BCE in Egypt. In sub-Saharan Africa, the Iron Age began far earlier than in Europe and the West, at a place called Obui. In Central African Republic, excavation of a ford yielded 8 consistent radiocarbon dates of 2000 BCE. So it's really, really early. Wow. And there's perhaps evidence of even earlier smithing in Cameroon. So in Central Europe, the Iron Age begins some 1,200 years later in the 8th century BCE, and in Northern Europe, some 1,400 years later in the 6th century BCE. So nobody was teaching blacksmithing as a new and novel thing to any Africans. This profoundly misunderstands, I think, medieval and early modern Africa as well. So this period in Africa is resplendent with cities and kingdoms and vast trade networks. In other words, Africa was not just a monolithic continent of unskilled labor. I would highly recommend reading The Golden Rhinoceros by Francis Xavier Fauvel. And he talks about the histories of the African Middle Ages, histories in the plural. And The Golden Rhinoceros is a beautifully crafted piece of postmodern history, which doesn't try to impose a single narrative on a whole continent for the period from the 7th to 15th century, but rather shows Africa's rich social diversity as a place of royals and thinkers and artists that played celebrated roles in an increasingly globalized world. Shows Africa as a vibrant place of the exchange of goods and ideas with many places that could be called crossroads of civilization. It's important to know that before, during, and after slavery and colonizations, Africans were not an unskilled mass that could personally benefit from whatever white Europeans or white Americans may deign to teach them. So my last point is number 10, slavery as an institution strips away human dignity. It does nothing to build it up. As Harriet Tubman said, "Now I have been free, I know what a dreadful condition slavery is. I've seen hundreds of escaped slaves, but never saw one willing to go back and be a slave." That's my last point. I will step down from my soapbox now.
Well, thank you so much for all of that. Really, really beautiful and detailed takedown of all of the nonsense in that claim that DeSantis and the Florida, I believe the Board of Education has made. And I think it's really important that we confront every single one of those points. And thank you for breaking them down so intricately. All of those are very important. And I mean, I'd heard about this. I'd heard about this curriculum change and it obviously bothered me. I obviously knew why it bothered me, but I couldn't articulate it as well as you just did. So those are at least 10 really good reasons to at least just question this idea. Even if you're not opposed to it yet, at least start questioning it. There's at least those 10 things wrong with it. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure we could think of more. It just kept me up at night. I had this other thing completely prepared for my stuff in the news and decided that if it's keeping me up this bad, I need to speak on it.
Well, it's probably keeping others up too, as it should. I mean, I obviously have a real problem anytime students, especially children, are taught utter propaganda. This is propaganda, is what it is. It's an attempt to soften slavery and make it seem like, oh, well, you know, it wasn't that bad, so don't feel that bad about yourselves. Like, I don't like this narrative of, well, let's definitely make kids feel bad about themselves, or let's definitely not make them feel bad about themselves. Like, I don't think it should have anything to do with how they feel, whether or not they feel guilty. I don't think we should be trying to make them feel guilty, but I don't think we should be tiptoeing around their feelings either. I think that the facts are the facts. History is history. It doesn't care how it makes you feel. So feel guilty or don't feel guilty, but know the information, know the truth.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think this whole sort of anti-woke agenda has many aspects, but this is distorting history.
Yeah.
And it's unnecessary, I think. The past, happened in the past. Assuming that modern children are going to carry that guilt and it, impact them means that, things that the British Empire did that are disgusting and horrible, British people can carry on with their lives after learning about them. Germany in the Nazi period, I mean, this is something mm-hmm. that German children are taught, and throughout the world, there's a need to know the truth and not have it sort of made palatable by this sort of distortion.
Right. And I think most rational people are in agreement that an entire race or group of people should not carry the burden of guilt for what other people of their nation did. That mm-hmm. doesn't mean they shouldn't know about it.
Yeah.
Everyone, people should know about these things. Everyone should have access to historical information, and it should be truthful information.
Okay, let's move on and talk about your stuff in the news.
Okay, well, my stuff in the news feels kind of disrespectful in juxtaposition to yours. Mine is quite lighthearted. So okay. I suppose if I'd known yours, I might have gone with something more serious, but I didn't. So I will actually share my screen because I need you to see this, this visual aid to my stuff in the news.
Okay. I see a penis.
good, yeah.
I see a person holding out their hands, and in their hands, across both palms, there is a pinkish brown object which seems to be globular, like testes on one end and sort of tapering to a glans on the other end. But I assume you're going to tell me that is not a penis and I have a dirty, dirty mind.
I mean, I wasn't expecting you to go into as much anatomical detail as you did, but I appreciate it. I think we can all benefit from that. So thank you. Yes, that does look like a penis, and not only to you. So you are not, it's not just you with the dirty mind. And these are not the hands of Lorena Bobbitt. And for those of you who, if anyone didn't get that reference, hello, Gen Z. This is called a penis fish.
That's a fish?
It's a worm, actually. Can you see?
Oh my god, that looks like a bunch of condoms. Slimy, blown up condoms.
Yeah, so I've just scrolled down to show an image of multiple of these penis fish together. They look exactly as Tracy has described. And so these are also called fat innkeeper worms, which is the least offensive of the two terms. Its Latin name is Urchis caupo. I don't think I pronounced that correctly, but anyway, well, let's just keep calling them penis fish because that is how the media has described them, with little explanation needed. And many, many, many of these have washed ashore in the United States, about on the west coast of the U.S., about 50 miles north of San Francisco.
Oh, okay. Hi, this is the Correction Fairy. The recent inundation of penis fish occurred on a beach in Rio Grande, Argentina. Drake's Beach, California, had their incident back in 2019. Carry on.
Yeah. So if you're walking around Northern California, you have undoubtedly, or maybe, I don't know, seen many of these what appear to be disembodied penises just flopping up on shore.
Oh my goodness. I have never seen anything that looks like that.
I haven't. I mean, like, no, I've never seen that.
Thank you for the quite appropriate correction of my statement there.
Sorry, Mom. So these have a fossil record that indicates they've been around for about at least 300 million years. And just
we take the picture down now.
Yeah, we can take it here. Let me stop sharing. Yeah.
I'm blushing. The picture of penis fish make me blush.
And I've done my job. But yeah, so they have a fossil record going back as far as 300 million years that we know of. One of these little bad boys can live to be 25 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
Sounds and like good pets.
I don't think so.
Can you imagine having an aquarium with those?
I'm going to refer to Lorena Bobbitt, who I picture having an aquarium full of these.
Yes.
But these are in the food chain of such predators as fish, otters, and sharks. So these are food for them, as well as people.
People eat penis fish.
They do. In fact, they are a delicacy in East Asia, especially in South Korea. Yeah.
I wonder what they taste like.
I don't.
You don't?
They don't look appetizing, but I also don't want to find out. That has been my stuff in the news, things you wish you didn't know edition.
Okay, so as I said, substituted my stuff in the news this week, early this morning. And so my stuff in the news I was going to do is now my piece of stuff. So I'm showing you a picture of my piece of stuff, which I guess is cheating because it's actually pieces of stuff this week. What do you make of this?
It is cheating. Yeah, I think it is cheating to have multiple pieces of stuff unless they're a part of a set.
They are.
So that's what that tells me. These are a part of a set. So I can't tell from the angle, but maybe like a tea set or something? I'm seeing what look from the top like either pieces of jewelry or like tea wear. I can't tell how dimensional these objects are, but I'm going to go with tea set or jewelry.
Okay. Lamps.
They're what?
Lamps.
Lamps? Oh.
Oil lamps.
Okay. All right. So they are three-dimensional.
Yeah, they're photographed from above.
Yeah. Got it.
I guess if you don't know the photograph from above, it'll be hard to tell what their lamps and.
I can see that.
What about the other thing?
That looks like a skull, like a human skull.
It is a human skull.
Okay, so now I have to figure out what these oil lamps are doing with this human skull. Now, it doesn't look like one of the lamps has fractured the skull. I see growth plates fused, although maybe not entirely fused. So this might be the skull of a child. But I don't see like fractures or holes that appear to be caused by a blunt object. So I will assume that these were just found together at the same archaeological site.
Yes.
Perhaps the, what I think is probably a child or a person who under age 25, let's say, had something to do with the lamps, sold them or made them or used them or something. Now I can see some paint on a couple of them. Looks like it's red that's worn away, although it could be rust. And I see some ornate patterning, which suggests that these were for a wealthy person. And they look to be made of some kind of early metal. But maybe iron just because I see rust, but I can't quite tell. Okay, I think that's oh, and the lamps are considerably smaller than the skull. So they must be tiny.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, these are pottery oil lamps from the late Roman Byzantine period. And so this was news that was reported this week on Heritage Daily and archaeology.net, which is where I discovered it, relating to the findings of Etienne Klein and Boaz Zizou regarding finds in a cave in Israel. So these were published online in Cambridge Core, which is an online journal of Cambridge University Press, earlier this month, with the title "Oil Lamps, Spearheads and Skulls, Possible Evidence of Necromancy During Late Antiquity in the Teumim Cave in the Judean Hills."
Is that what the skulls doing there? They were trying to resurrect the person?
This is evidence of necromancy, apparently.
Wow.
And I just got to say, this is a really enjoyable and accessible article. Of course, I'm going to link it in the show notes, and I highly recommend it. Sometimes archaeological articles can be a little dense. They have a lot of factual information to convey, so that's part of their job. But this is really accessible. Teumim Cave is a karst cave, which means it's of a soluble material like limestone. So it can be eroded to form crevices and pits, etc. And so I'm first going to describe the cave and then describe what was found there. And then finally, the argument that Klein and Zizou come up for this being necromancy, because that's kind of the way they lay it out in their article, and it makes a lot of sense. If you looked at a plan of the cave, it looks a little bit like a squashed circle with a passage, a natural passage, heading off slightly northwards. So the cave is quite big, about 50 meters by 70 meters, which is about 165 by 230 feet, for those of us that work in feet. And it's accessible by a north facing entrance, which was originally a natural opening that had been enlarged by people hewing at the stone. The floor of the main chamber is very higgledy-piggledy, which I think is the correct archaeological term.
I was going to ask if that was the technical terminology. Yeah,
I think so, yes. Okay. So it's mostly covered with large piles of rocks. And these rocks, in many instances, are covering fissures and narrow passages, crevices in this rubble that lead to cavities and crevices. And it's these that have proved very rich in the archaeological finds. So as I said, there's a passage which extends north about 20 meters, so about 65 feet. And about a third of the way up this passage, there's a very large pit across the whole of the passage. So this is about 20 feet wide at the top. And it's about 75 feet deep from the ceiling to the bottom. So it's a big pit. But people had obviously crossed this pit, as there are archaeological finds, lamps, storage jars, and hoards of coins on the other side of the pit. And the other major feature of the cave is a watercourse, a man-made watercourse. So there's a square foot pool about 6 feet by 6 feet, which is used to collect the water that drips from the cave ceiling. So the cave has these stalactites on the ceiling, and some water drips from those, and then it flows west through a man-made channel. And originally it would have been collected in another pool built later further down, but this now it just kind of seeps into the ground. So there are also several other places in the entrance chamber area where there were pools or storage vessels which were used to collect this dripping water. So obviously taking the water there, this mineral water, heavily enriched mineral water, was thought to be healthy. And so we're already looking at quite a magical place. This is a cave, and its association with the underworld is enhanced by this deep pit. We've got rocks that ooze mineral water in a very dry place. And so this sort of further enhances the idea of a connection with underground or chthonic gods. So let's move on to the finds in the cave. Teanim Cave included 120 of those lamps, mostly intact, and coins from the late Roman period, early Byzantine period. So this is the period that we're interested in for the time period that necromancy was practiced here, the second to fourth centuries CE. So since 2009, a team of archaeologists in a joint project from, this is going to be a bit of a mouthful, the Martin Sazus Department of Land of Israel Studies and Archaeology at Bar Ilan University and the Cave Research Center at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, these guys have been exploring the Teyamim Cave. Now, the cave got its name because local residents in the 19th century called the cave Mugharet Tuamin. Forgive my...
It's pretty good.
Not so bad?
It's not bad.
Not bad.
Nicely done.
Okay, I tried. So,
good job.
Which means the cave of the mother of twins. And so the cave was known locally for its healing properties of its spring water, but also as a cure for infertility. And the eponymous mother there had taken the waters and became pregnant with twins. So, you know, magically cured her infertility. As well as these sort of late Roman, early Byzantium lamps, there were also excavations earlier at the cave in the 20s and the 70s that found Neolithic and Chalcolithic finds, as well as early and middle Bronze Age and Iron Age finds, as well as these finds from the Roman and Byzantine period. So we can safely say that the cave has had a local significance for thousands of years, okay? But it's the most recent excavations that point to the use of the cave for necromancy, or as a necomantion, an oracle of the dead. And these finds included three human cranium, which is what we've been looking at. So this is the top part of the skull. And no other human bones are found in the cave. So this is not somebody who died in there. This detached cranium has been brought in.
So it's only the cranium? It's not the whole skull?
It's not the whole skull. It's just the cranium. Just
That's interesting.
Part, yes.
I wonder why they wouldn't just take the whole skull.
Well, I guess the jawbone falls off quite easily.
Is the maxilla attached, you know?
No.
The top? No?
The top part. I don't know. I've only seen this one picture, and it's referred to as a cranium. Okay. So I know there's no lower jaw.
That's so interesting.
So this picture shows how they were found in situ. So the skull is on top of these late Roman, early Byzantine lamps. So, you know, they have been deposited together. And they were found in very hard to reach crevices. So not just scattered around. So one of these skulls was found near a large depression, another near the entrance to the passage, and the last near the rock cut pool. So, as I said, one of the craniums was found placed on top of four oil lamps of the third to fourth centuries. And this gives us a rough date for the deposit of these objects. And some of these 120 oil lamps that they found have been thrust so far into crevices that they had to be retrieved with a long hook on a pole. And it seems that this is the way they might have been deposited as well, that nobody could have put their arm that far in. They had to be inserted, you know, as far in as they could go, probably using a hook and a pole.
Probably in the dark, too.
Yeah, once you've got rid of your lamp. I assume you've taken another lamp as well as the lamp that you're taking to deposit.
Yeah, one would hope.
So additional associated finds include three bronze objects, an axe and two spearheads from the Intermediate Bronze Age, and a small bronze jug from the Early Bronze Age, as well as a Middle Bronze Age bowl, which isn't of metal, it's of either stone or ceramic. So the last was deposited on top of three further lamps. So that the Bronze Age stuff is being placed in and among and on top of the datable lamps.
Hmm.
So it seems that whoever was using the lamps and the skulls in the late Roman, early Byzantine period was also using them in conjunction with much older Bronze Age vessels and edged weapons.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? So does all this add up to necromancy? Well, Eating Klein and Boaz Zizou make a very convincing argument that it does, though they do caution about identifying magical practices in archaeological evidence. It's no simple thing. So they back up their material evidence with a plethora of written evidence of the practices, locations, and equipment that were used in necromancy. But before we get to the written evidence, I want to do a little bit of historical research into this area of Israel so we can know whose written evidence we need to interrogate for the evidence of necromancy. So the Tiamim caves were located between the city of Aelia Capitolina, which is what the Romans renamed Jerusalem, and the city of Eleutheropolis. So this is in the heart of the area that was repopulated by Gentiles in the period following the Third Jewish Revolt, or the Bar Kokhba Revolt. So the Bar Kokhba Revolt was the third big rebellion of Jews in the Roman province of Judea against, of course, the Roman Empire. And it was fought from 132 to 136 CE, led by Simon Bar Kokhba. And I think more people are aware of the first Jewish revolt, 66 to 73, which is when the Second Temple was destroyed and Jerusalem was overtaken, than they are of the Third Revolt. But in sort of world historical terms, the Third Revolt probably has more significance to the Jewish diaspora. So while Josephus's claim that over 100 million people were killed by Titus in the first revolt is definitely exaggerated, there was a large-scale loss of life and enslavement of Jews following the first revolt. But it's the third revolt and its aftermath that saw the Jewish population of the region of Judea completely devastated, almost completely wiped out, killed, exiled, or sold into slavery. And this has led some scholars to call the aftermath of the third revolt a genocide. So Jews were expelled from the area of Jerusalem and the area round about. And as I said, Jerusalem itself was largely destroyed and rebuilt as Aelia Capitolina. The proximate reason for the revolt was a proposal to build a temple to Jupiter on the Temple Mount. This Hadrian did in the aftermath of the Third Revolt and dedicated it not just to Jupiter, but also to himself. Yeah,
of course.
That's the nature of Roman Empire, emperors, gods. So the province of Judea was even renamed Syria Palestine. So far, there's been no excavation of any village in Judea that does not show it was destroyed in the Third Revolt. So everywhere they've excavated shows destruction in the Third Revolt. So I think we can safely conclude that Jewish settlement in the area around the Tiamim Caves had almost been eradicated by the end of the Third Revolt. Jews were not completely emptied from the area. Jewish communities continued to live on the edges of Judea, and many Judean survivors moved to Galilee. And Galilee became a very important center for Judaism in the second to fourth centuries. This is where the Mishnah and part of the Talmud were composed. But in Tiamin and the surrounding areas, in the period following the Third Revolt, the population would have been Gentile. The area was repopulated by non-Jewish residents. And so it would have been these people that were responsible for this possible necromancy related to the lamps and skulls and spearheads deposited in the Tiamin caves between the second to fourth centuries. So that being said, necromancy had been practiced throughout the ancient Middle and Near East, Greece and Rome, and influences may have come from or been taken as far away as places like Egypt and Britain. The cultural flow is just really hard to determine. So necromancy is basically the practice of communicating with the dead, often in order to predict the future. So nowadays, I think if somebody hears the word necromancy, they might relate it to Dungeons and Dragons or video games, in which the necromancer's special skill is reanimating corpses to use them as weapons against their enemies. In the ancient past, the reason to sort of bring back a spirit or apparition of the dead or a vision of the dead was to try to discover hidden knowledge. So the word necromancy is ancient Greek compound of necros, meaning dead body, and mantia for divination. So necromancy in the ancient world was more like is depicted on this 5th century BC vase, Greek vase that's now in the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. So this vase depicts the moment in Homer's Odyssey when Odysseus encounters the ghost of his dead companion, Alepnor. So in the Odyssey, Alepnor got drunk at Circe's palace and fell off the battlements to his death. So Odysseus calls him back up to talk to him and exclaims, "Alepnor, how did you come here beneath the fog and darkness?" So on the vase, Alepnor is the naked guy on the left who's rising out of the waters of the Acherusian Lake. And this is one of the four seats of the Oracle of the Dead. So in the center of the vase, there's Odysseus with the carcasses of the two black sheep at his feet, which he has just sacrificed. And their blood drains from their necks into a round offering pit. And the ghost then sips from this blood and is briefly able to recover a little bit of their corporeal state in this way.
How gruesome.
It is gruesome, yes. I should have given a trigger warning there about animal worm.
Yeah, the blood drinking, I think, did it, yeah.
Yeah.
Trigger warning, blood trigger drinking. Warning.
Belated trigger warning. Odysseus, as you can see, has wisely kept hold of his knife, not to ward off any unwelcome ghosts that might come with Alepnor, because iron or bronze was supposed to inspire fear in the dead. And of course, we find these iron spearheads and an axe in the cave. So the third person on the scene on the right, distinguishable by his winged helmet and boots, and the caduceus staff, is of course Hermes. And Hermes' task was to escort the dead into the underworld, but he seems also to have been the one responsible for bringing them back again in case anybody fancies a chat. So sometimes the spirits were called up to reveal secrets that they'd taken with them to the grave. But at other times they were called up to predict the future. It seems like the future was known in the realm of the dead. So in Virgil's Aeneid, Aeneas descends into the underworld and he witnesses this parade, this marshalling of Rome's future heroes, none of which have been yet born. So he can see this future event happening in the underworld.
It's funny you mentioned Virgil. I was, as you were saying, talking about this, what called to mind was Dante's Inferno.
Oh, yeah.
Where Virgil's the guide. So I was, the reference is there.
Yeah. So Plato believed that the soul, once it's separated from the burden of this horrible dross matter of our body, had greater powers of perception and could understand the processes of the universe. So this might be sort of part of what the spirit can do as opposed to what an embodied, spirit inside your person can do. So necromancy could be practiced at the gravesite of a particular person that you wanted to talk to, but one could also communicate with the dead at a special site, maybe such as the Teomim caves. So in ancient sources, there were four such sites named in the Greco-Roman world. Two of these were caves, two of them were lakes, but it, this doesn't preclude Tayammim being another, perhaps a more local spot for an oracle, or maybe somewhere an oracle visited, or somewhere that was established as an oracle site once this area of Judea was repopulated with new people that brought these practices with them. So we look at the archaeological assemblage, the skulls, the lamps, the spearheads, axe, etc., the bowl that might have been used for catching blood or for drinking water from. Oh, for drinking blood from, yes. I think
just had to throw that out there.
The ghosts, I think, were supposed to drink the blood, not the not the necromancer.
But well, you know.
Whatever. And I think the necromancy seems likely. It wouldn't be the only cultic site in Israel in this period. From the time of Hadrian to the time of Constantine, the Grotto of the Nativity in Bethlehem was also used as a cultic site. And I did not know that. That's something I learned. So let's think about these different elements. Lamps had... have a strong connection to magic. You know, I think we can all recognize the connection with the tale of genies in the lamp, for example. But there's also a type of oil lamp divination called lychnomancy or lampadomancy or lampadomancy.
I've never heard that. That's interesting.
Yeah, well, divination was done by interpreting the shapes created by a flame. And obviously a cave is a really good place to do this.
Yeah, no light.
Yeah.
No outside light.
In many of these descriptions of this ritual, a young boy was used as a medium to, to voice the spirit, the speaking of the dead. And there are several places in Greece and Rome where hundreds of lamps have been ritually deposited, like they are in Tayammim Cave. So Pliny the Elder, who died in 79 CE, writes in his Natural History that magic was introduced to the Greeks by the Persians, and specifically by a magus called Osthanes, who accompanied Xerxes in the invasion of Greece in the 5th century BCE. So, yeah, if it's magical and weird, blame it on the Persians, I think, is this.
I think that sounds like a pretty good bet in general. Although, again, like we talked about last time with fragrance, I'm skeptical of the idea that magic is one of those things that started somewhere and then, the idea spread.
Somewhere else. I agree. But according to Pliny, Osthanes says, there are several forms of magic. He professes to divine from water, globes, air, stars, lamps, basins, and axes, and by many other methods besides, to converse with ghosts and those in the underworld. And so from this list that we get from Pliny, at the site at Tayammim, we have the water, the lamps, the basins and bowls, and the axes present. So the Bronze Age axe head and the spear points and the Bronze Age bowl were ritual objects, possible ritual objects, that were very, very old already at the time of their use and a deposition in the cave. So the real clincher, I think, is, of course, the three cranium, the three skulls. So the idea of using skulls for magic is really, really old. There's a tablet from Mesopotamia. As far back as the first millennium BCE, a clay tablet survives with cuneiform writing that details a ritual for consulting a spirit of the dead. And Klein and Zizou quote this in their article. So this evokes the god, sun god Samas. So I'll quote from this. "Dust of the underworld, may he bring up a ghost from the darkness for me. May he put life back in the dead man's limbs. I call upon you, O skull of skulls. May he who is in the skull answer me. O Samas, who brings light in." the spooky stuff, huh? That, you know, there we have like actual proof that, you know, at least according to this tablet, that's what you wanted to do with a skull of skulls. If you wanted it to talk to you, you made that indication. Yeah,
that sounds like a 90s horror movie, like a good one.
A good one, yeah. So in fast forward to the Roman period, and necromancy was sometimes associated with human sacrifice and was viewed negatively. So laws were passed to outlaw witchcraft, divination, and human sacrifice, both in the Republic and the Imperial periods. But hypocrites as they are, this did not stop emperors practicing necromancy. And there's evidence of Nero, Hadrian, Commodus, Caracalla, and Elagabalus, who are documented as participating in necromancy. And then we got the apostate emperor Valerian. And, you know, our sources for this are Christian and therefore suspect, but he is said to have been persuaded by an Egyptian sorcerer to slit the throat of children and to inquire of the entrails of newborns to achieve success. Yeah.
There's a similar story in the Armenian sources about, was it Constantine or one of the Byzantine emperors, being instructed by the mages, I think Persian mages, to bathe in the blood of children. And, but in the stories, he's like, no, I can't do it. And he's like kind of held up. But yeah, so I guess that's a thing. I guess that's like a trope, although a lot of variations.
Yeah. So foreign wizards telling you to do terrible things seems to be a...
To children in particular.
To children, yeah.
Yeah.
So the skulls thing, the skull necromancy thing, may have been common, as in the 3rd century CE, the theologian Hippolytus of Rome set about debunking the practice. And this is like sort of almost like one of those debunking psychic shows. And so I'm going to quote from this and ramble a little bit. But he said that in order to do this fake necromancy, the place a skull on the ground and appear to make it talk in the following way. It is made of an ox's caul, which is its the membrane that's around a newborn calf. So you take that and it's molded with Tyrrhenian wax and freshly mixed gypsum. And then the membrane, this ox's caul, is spread about it until it has the appearance of a skull. It seems to speak to all when an instrument is operated. So preparing the windpipe of a crane or other long-necked animal, a fellow jester secretly attaches it to the skull, uttering what he wants. So he makes the skull seem to speak. Wow. And then if he wants the skull to disappear magically, he surrounds it with a heap of coal and appears to offer incense. And of course, the wax absorbing the heat from the coal melts. And so the skull is thought to disappear. So it seems that the practice was widespread enough for fakery as elaborate as this to be going on, and for the need for Hippolytus to debunk it. So I think we might safely say that skull necromancy was at least a known practice, something that people believed in.
Okay, so what I want to see is I want, like, on the History Channel, a TV show where they replicate this, where they take all those ingredients and they try to, like, follow the instructions of Hippolytus and just be like, we're gonna repeat this experiment, like a Mythbusters, but for, like, nerdy people.
Very nerdy people that would also sort of quote the cuneiform tablets in Tusa Mass in the original language.
So I feel like that should be our next podcast.
Yeah, we should do a live one where we try to recreate this with fire extinguishers at the ready.
Okay, you get the calf membrane.
Yeah, I probably got more chance of getting one of those. Oh, I don't know whether would you have more chance of getting one out there in Michigan or in New York? I wonder.
I mean, probably. You probably go into a shop, like a bodega, right, and just be like, okay, bring me a cast member. And they'd be like, all right. Because there's just so much weird stuff in New York.
Yeah, 3 hours. So there we have it. Skulls, water, ancient edged weapons and bowls that were already ancient in the second or third century. What's I meant to say? And those lamps that were hidden in inaccessible crevices, the pit to the underworld, the water that flows miraculously from rocks. It seems like a pretty magical place for some pretty magical rites, which all seem to point strongly to necromancy.
That's really interesting. And especially I was surprised to hear the date on this thing, because I wouldn't expect that, like, necromancy or any kind of pagan ritual to be such a big thing still in that time period. I mean, I guess certainly the Jewish tradition in that area, I would have expected to take hold such that it would be like, oh, you can't do that to a dead body. You can't desecrate a skull like that. And then with Christianity having come through the area, I wasn't expecting necromancy, because obviously it was a gradual process. It wasn't like overnight everybody had, you know, respect for this idea of the afterlife. But still, I'm surprised to hear that this, you know, at this time, this recently, this practice would have been going on this intricately.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to be a real practice and not just a thing that people say in texts about other people doing it, like the rituals involving children we just mentioned. It really does seem like this is evidence of actual practice, and probably an imported practice with the repopulation of the area, something that may have been brought in, although there are mentions of necromancy, of course, in the Bible as well, and it's forbidden specifically by certain rabbis of the period as well. So it seems to be like a Mediterranean area wide practice, maybe not practiced continually, but certainly a very well known idea that's mentioned both in literature and in now we've got evidence in the archaeology as well.
Well, that's really interesting.
I thought so.
Well, thank you for sharing that, your skull and stuff.
My skull and stuff. That's what we should request. Our secret society of Patreons, when we get them, will be the skull and stuff.
Instead of skull and bone, skull and stuff. All right, Tracy, would you like to see my piece of stuff?
I'd love to see your piece of stuff.
Let's do it.
Oh, okay. So we're looking at a manuscript page. I was trying to make it a little bit bigger. It looks
here. I don't know if that helps.
Not that I'm gonna be able to read it. because I don't know what language that is. It looks like Arabic to me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So yes and no, but I'll get there.
Okay. Though it has I go with Arabic, and it has marginalia, kind of an extensive comment in the margin, written at a crazy angle, which looks like how I scroll in the margins of my books, which is actually fun to do now on my age. Sometimes I'm pulling books off my shelves that I've read 20 years ago and reading my comments from 20 years ago. And it's like having this weird conversation with myself. So let me see. I think that's in the same language, but
it is actually, you know, it's funny. I didn't notice until you were talking about the marginalia that it's written upside down.
The marginalia is written upside down.
Yeah, I didn't even notice that at first, but it definitely is, which suggests that the author, and we see this in Armenian manuscripts too. This is not an Armenian, but we see this in Armenian manuscripts where the person will just write all around the margins, and it won't necessarily be in the same, right side up or upside down as the text of the main body.
You see, obviously, writing in the margins in Christian texts too, and sometimes deliberately so. And I think this is the same in Jewish texts as well, that you end up with like a little tiny bit of the original text in the center, and then everybody's comments around it, which are then copied from manuscript to manuscript to manuscript. So the actual text gets smaller and smaller, and all the commentaries carry on around it. Yeah. But I hadn't noticed it was upside down. It looks slightly different than the other text. And that's about all I can tell. This seems to be, I would say, on animal skin, on parchment.
Probably parchment. That actually didn't come up in my reading about it, but probably, yeah.
Okay, so I have nothing on date or location.
All right, so let me tell you. So there wasn't an exact date either, but I'm going to guess between 1530 and 1550. And certainly it had to be by 1558 because that was the year in which the author died. And I will tell you about the author because this is the most interesting thing to me. This is a letter written by Hürrem Sultan, or as some historians refer to her, Roxolana, who was the chief consort and eventually the legal wife, which is huge, I'll get there, of the Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent. Of the Ottoman Empire.
Him with now, the big turban.
Yeah, with the as my students call it, a big-ass onion is how one of them described it. So this is a letter written by his chief consort, who eventually became his legal wife. Now, does anything surprise you about seeing this letter?
I think, first off, that it's written by a woman.
Exactly. And why does that surprise you?
Because I would have assumed that Ottoman women at this time, even of high status, would not have been literate.
Yeah. Most women in most places at this time and before were not literate, but women at the Ottoman court, even slaves, which Hürrem was. So really interesting conversation about slavery in this episode, kind of on both sides of what we might call modernity, both sides of transatlantic contact. Hürrem was literate, as were all of virtually all of the enslaved women who were just like her. Now, this is, you were right to identify Arabic. That is the script used, but this is actually in Ottoman Turkish.
Script is Arabic, but the language is Ottoman Turkish. Okay.
Yeah. So Turkish was written in the Arabic script until the reforms of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk in the 20th century. Now it's written in Latin script. So this is Ottoman Turkish. And it's written in a very clear hand, which tells me that this was probably written quite late in her life, and she had a number of years to learn to write the language. It's not written like someone who has an unsteady, unsure command of writing in Arabic script. It looks to be written by someone who has more of a command of it.
It's neat, and it's neat, and it's kind of cursively written rather than being laid out like very slowly and deliberately like a manuscript. You can imagine somebody or her, you know, writing this, not copying it, and not writing while she was composing, and quite swiftly.
Yeah. Now, the other possibility is that she dictated this to a scribe. So I guess I can't say for sure. That also didn't come up in my reading about this particular letter, but she was known to have handwritten her own letters to Suleiman. So I guess whether this particular one was dictated or handwritten by her isn't really that important. The important thing that I wanted to talk about today is that she herself eventually became literate. Well, not even eventually, pretty early on was taught literacy. So I wanted to talk today. I wanted to use this as a jumping off point to discuss the Sultanate of Women. I'm sure you've heard of that term before.
Yes.
And I love talking about this phenomenon in Ottoman history. It's super interesting. So the Sultanate of Women was this time period that spans from the rise of Hürrem Sultan through the reign of probably Çorhan Sultan, who was the consort of one of Hürrem's descendants. And it's this period where women really were given, rose to extreme power in the Ottoman court, and had, in many cases, more power than the male sultans themselves. So we talk about the Sultanate of Women commencing with the rise of Roxolana, or Hürrem is the name that she was given by Suleiman, Hürrem meaning the joyful one or the cheerful one. because apparently she had a nice happy attitude, which probably helped her get in the bedroom of the Sultan, which was the aspiration for the most part of all these girls that came to the Ottoman harem, the harem being the women's quarters. And mm-hmm. and by the way, harem is not only for for sexual slaves, really, but it was the quarters for all women, the Sultan's family, his sisters, his mother, and they would just live in these tiered residences. So the very bottom were these like barracks where the lowest level of, I guess, freshly captured women would live. Mm-hmm. And then if a woman rose to the level of haseki or favorite, she would rise in station and in architecture. She would get a nice room to herself, or maybe she'd only have one roommate, but she wouldn't be in the barracks anymore.
Right.
And then all the way up to the Sultan's mother, who would be queen mother really during this time. And she would have this grand, amazing chamber all to herself. And it was like pretty much the nicest part of the palace. So there were these tiered levels to women in the harem itself. But Roxolana came from an area known as Ruthenia, which is believed to be at the time part of Poland, modern day Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
She probably arrived circa 1520, and there were a number of ways in which women, or girls really, because she was probably quite young, a teenager at this time, there were a number of ways in which girls could arrive at the Ottoman court. The most common was that they would be captured by slavers, usually Crimean Tatars, not exclusively, but usually Crimean Tatars who were agents of this Ottoman slave trade. They would then be brought to slave bazaars and then purchased by agents of one of the palaces. There were a number of palaces that were seats of power in the Ottoman Empire. So Roxolana came to Topkapı Palace, which mm-hmm. was the, you know, the main big palace in the center of Constantinople. And she became a consort to the Sultan, which was the goal. This was the dream, right? Because not all of the girls who made it to the harem enslaved, and they were technically slaves because they were the property of yeah. the Sultan, and that was the thing that made them slaves, and we'll talk about that in a sec. But not all of them wound up in the Sultan's bed. In fact, comparatively very few of them actually did. Many of them would rise to different stations. So they might become a kalfa, which was like a female administrator, like an overseer, or she might become even a doctor. Like they would call it like a lady doctor, like a female doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of a midwife or a wet nurse even. There were a lot of different stations that women could rise to once they passed through those doors and became technically a slave of the Sultan. And slavery in this historical setting is nothing like the kind of slavery we were talking about at the beginning of our episode, transatlantic slavery, chattel slavery that we saw after Columbian contact. Nothing like it. So in this setting, slavery was much different. So these women who were enslaved, because they were the property of the Sultan, they had totally different conditions. They could and frequently did earn wages.
Okay.
And they would get like pay raises based on how high up they had been promoted through those ranks.
Mm-hmm.
And male slaves enjoyed this right too. And male and female slaves had protection rights. So they couldn't be beaten too harshly. They had certain rights to their property, and they could own property, and they frequently did. So it's not at all like what we think of with chattel slavery. It's a completely different institution. It's also not inherently race-based, because these girls and boys who became enslaved in the palace came from all over. In fact, they mostly came from Christian provinces or territories, partly because there were rules governing the enslavement of Muslims. You couldn't enslave a freeborn Muslim, so most of these slaves were Christian-born. And there was also this desire for girls who had very light skin contrasted with very dark hair. So for those who know me, I would have commanded a very high price in the Ottoman Empire.
I think you would have, yes.
Yeah. but that was like the look. That was the thing they found most attractive. And these girls primarily inhabited areas like the Caucasus, unsurprisingly. So they would particularly kidnap young girls from this area to bring to the Sultan. You know, they would command a high price. They would get paid handsomely for them. So girls who looked like this, who had this light skin and dark hair combination, were like, you know, kind of the the trendy hot thing, I don't know, at the Ottoman court during this time. So Roxolana could have gone in a number of different ways. She could have become a kalfa. She could have become a wet nurse, a doctor, I guess what we might today call an obstetrician. But she didn't, because she found her way into the bed of Suleiman the Magnificent. And she was really lucky to have done this, because if you found your way into the Sultan's bed and you were really lucky, he got you pregnant. Now, if he got you pregnant with a girl, with a female child, then your life is pretty good. You got promoted and you got nice things and you got the title Sultan attached to your name. You got to have finery. You got a salary that was raised and it was higher than some of the other women. And you basically just had this nice, luxurious lifestyle just for having birthed a child to the Sultan. If you delivered a male child, your life was even better in some ways, because then your child could become Sultan himself. And if your child, if your male child did become Sultan, then you yourself would be elevated to the position of Valide, Queen Mother. And that was
the pinnacle.
It was the pinnacle. It was one of the highest positions in the Ottoman Empire. And in some ways, the Valide was even potentially more powerful than her son. And in some cases, she was, actually. And we'll try to talk about a few of those if we have time. But and there were a couple of different ways a woman could enter the Sultan's bedchamber. Now, it's said that he might indicate his desire for her by tossing her his handkerchief.
Okay.
So that, you know, pretty clear signal, but that wasn't always the case. Often, very often, these concubines would be chosen for the Sultan and sent to his bedroom by, any guesses? Who
his
might have
mother.
Made this call? His mother, that's right. Yeah.
So
and yeah. And when I tell my students this, they all just they just cringe and die and throw up. They're just so horrified. And it's funny to me every single time. But if you think about it, there are a lot of advantages to this, right? Like there's something to be said for mama knowing best. She wants to make sure that the person who will birth her grandchild and heir to the throne is someone intelligent, someone who has nice looks, like all her teeth, someone who is cunning and smart and pretty. You know, you want your grandchild to inherit good qualities. So it makes sense that the person who would birth the heir to the throne would be chosen by someone who kind of knows what to look for.
Yeah, that they want somebody who can potentially be like them, that could is potentially going to be a future queen mother.
Yeah. Right. And these queen mothers, in a lot of cases, are political actors. So they had to have political acumen, or at least the intellectual capacity to develop political acumen. Someone who could represent the Ottoman Empire well diplomatically, as did Hürrem, in fact. So what's interesting here is I mentioned that Hürrem became the legal wife of Suleiman the Magnificent, and this was really not done before. The last time a sultan married was in the 14th century. The second sultan of the Ottoman Empire, Sultan Orhan, married a Byzantine princess to cement a political alliance.
So it's been 200 years or so since the Sultan had a wife?
Yeah, 1347, I think it was.
Okay.
And the Sultans stopped marrying because of the damage that these political alliances could cause them, right? They had costs associated with them. One of the big problems was that if you intermarry with a political ally or political rival, or an ally that becomes a rival, then they might have a claim on your throne.
Right.
And they saw this happening with other European empires. As we know, this famously plagued England with the Catholic monarchs and all that. So the Ottomans were like, "Yeah, we don't have time for this. We're not doing this." So they stopped marrying.
The whole basis of the Hundred Years' War between France and England. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So they were like, "We're not doing this. We are going to procreate. Now we're not going to marry, so that we don't have any political entanglements, no other claims to our throne. We are just going to procreate through concubines." And the advantage there is they own the concubines. So no Ottoman Sultan had married since 1347, at the time that Suleiman met Roxolana. But she quickly became the only woman in his heart, the only woman in his bed. And he married her in about 1534, scholars think. And this was fortuitously timed, He may have wanted to marry her much earlier than this. However, his mother was still alive until about 1534. And if he had married Hürrem or Roxolana while his mother was still alive, there would have been that conflict of which woman was more powerful.
Yeah, and there was no precedent, really, because it hadn't happened in over 200 years.
Right. Yeah. So it's believed that out of respect for his mother, Hafsa, he waited to marry Roxolana until Hafsa passed. So, and the other major violation, aside from him marrying a concubine, now he had to legally free her before he could marry her.
Because he couldn't marry a slave.
Right. So he granted her her freedom and then married her, made her his legal wife. And the other hoop that she jumped through that she wasn't supposed to jump through, I don't think there are any records of other women jumping through before Roxolana or Hürrem. I keep jumping between calling her by those two names because historians do as well. Well, I guess I am a historian now. Anyway, I still have the imposter syndrome. So Hürrem was called back to Suleyman's bed even after birthing a son for him. And this was taboo because you were not supposed to bear more than one son to the Sultan.
Oh, right. So they didn't become rivals and kill each other?
Exactly, yeah. So the Ottoman sultans had a tradition of killing all of their half-brothers at the time of accession to the throne. Because, again, going back to that, rival claim into the throne thing, they didn't want that. They didn't want anybody having an uprising, having a right to hold an uprising. What if a European ally or some other rival comes along and says, well, we don't like the current sultan, we're going to back your brother and lead an uprising? They didn't want that.
Yeah.
So the idea was that you had to execute all of your brothers once you took the throne so that you eliminated the possibility of an insurrection or some kind of opposition. Wow. That didn't always happen, but it was, it was supposed to. There are some notable cases. If I have time, I'll talk about them. But if you had a daughter, then you could still keep getting called to the Sultan's bedchamber if he wanted you. But once you had a son, it was game over. And the mother was seen as the political advisor to her son. And she was supposed to devote everything she had to her son. Mm-hmm. So she couldn't devote herself to two rivals. That was a big no-no. So it had to be like one mother, one son.
Yeah. Well, if we think of examples from English history, like the whole debacle that happens when there are multiple sons with King Richard and King John, and they just kind of tore the country apart. You can see the sense in this, though the killing of your brothers seems a bit extreme.
It was extreme. And it also wasn't a system of primogeniture. It wasn't like the oldest automatically got the throne. It was somewhat of a meritocracy. So we see this with like Chinggis Khan, right? They didn't care who the oldest was. They cared who the best one was and who could win the most political favor. So it didn't matter the birth order. But so Hürrem births a son, Mehmet, to Suleyman. And he's like, I don't care. I'm gonna keep calling her to my bedchamber. Mm-hmm. And she bears him a number of sons, more than one son. And actually his first son with her, who was, I think, his second son overall, was the favorite to accede the throne after his death. But unfortunately, their son Mehmet died of smallpox pretty early on.
Oh.
Not like early, he wasn't a baby, but I don't think he'd reached adulthood yet. He was probably before 18, I think. So Hürrem jumped through a lot of hoops, and she's one of these figures that I really love for that reason. This woman was brought, or this young girl really, was brought as a slave in chains, maybe not literal chains, I don't actually know, but certainly metaphorical chains, if not physical ones, and then became queen, became the most powerful woman in the Ottoman Empire. And it's a great story. Like I'll think of her sometimes when I'm like, oh no, I can't do this. The thing I want to do, I'm not good enough to do it. And then I'll remind myself like, okay, well, Hürrem came to the Ottoman Empire as a slave and then became a queen. So stop whining. she really is actually one of my like inspirations. And she didn't just, it's easy to dismiss her and say, oh, well, she literally slept her way to the top because she got her power through sex. But it was more than that, because we see her engaging in diplomacy, writing letters to foreign monarchs, acting as a proxy for Suleyman in some political proceedings. So she was intelligent. She worked hard. She really did work her way to the top. by having this political acumen and this intelligence and this shrewdness, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
and I think the slavery aside, it's not that different from European queenship. Mm. You know, there's no choice in who you matter. The marriage is made to seal a deal for an alliance, etc. And the young woman is usually very young, you know, 13 or 14, etc. And it goes to a foreign court, completely different language, maybe only a couple of advisors. And her job is to have children. But the queens that make it, very notable queens, realize that the job is like far more than that, and are very astute politically, religiously, and make these connections, make diplomacy work. And it's a very intensely involved political job.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And that brings me back to this letter. So Hürrem, like all girls that came to the Ottoman court, were taught to read. And that was one of the most important things. They were taught other skills too. They were taught needlework, and they would make needlework that would then be sold in the bazaars to make money for the palace.
Oh,
and many of them, and many of them could become quite good at it and earn wages doing it. They were taught other skills. So these girls were taught, number one, to read. Number two, they were taught about Islam. They were taught the Quran. So literacy really was at the core of the harem system. So it's quite unusual and really cool that these young girls were brought in as slaves, and immediately it was like, we're going to get them to read, because they're not going to be useful to us at all in any capacity if they can't read. Mm-hmm. And especially if one of these girls is going to become Valide, queen mother, she needs to be literate. And often they would need her to be literate in multiple languages, as was the Sultan himself.
And I was going to comment just briefly about janissaries. The mm-hmm. idea that, you know, boys were also bought from Christian parts to become slave soldiers in the Ottoman mm-hmm. court. You know, that it's not just a sort of sex trafficking sort of mm-hmm. thing. It's a trafficking in human people that you can then control and should be trustworthy, because mm-hmm. they owe everything to the Sultan, and they are property.
Right. Yeah. And in a lot of ways, the system of the janissaries and that the harem, the enslaved girls who came to the harem, those are two parallel institutions. And they function very much the same way. The janissaries, for those who don't know, were kind of like the SEAL Team 6 of the Ottoman military, like really elite military corps of soldiers. It's really difficult to talk about Ottoman slavery, any kind of analog to post-Columbian transatlantic slavery. There were nothing alike. In fact, the system of enslaving young children produced, I think, every single grand vizier in Ottoman history.
Mm-hmm.
So these boys would ascend politically, and again, they would be the property of the Sultan, and therefore that's what made them technically slaves. But they learned to read, they learned skills, and then I'm sure Ron DeSantis would love to politicize that, but in this case, it's actually true. They did learn skills in the Ottoman system, and they advanced and earned wages and were chief political actors, very potent political actors. This also kind of put a target on their back too, though. So many grand viziers would be killed for not being loyal enough. And that also brings me to one of the ways in which, if you were a consort of the Sultan, your life might be a little better if you did not bear a son, if you bore a daughter instead, because if you bore a mm-hmm. son, then you would have to live with the constant fear that your son would be strangled by one of his brothers.
Oh,
and it was generally strangulation, because they didn't want to spill blood of the dynasty. So mm-hmm. strangulation was the preferred method with a gara.
If the sons were killed, were the mothers still okay in the harem, or were they expelled?
They frequently would be permitted to stay, I believe. I know in some cases they did leave and went off to other palaces. So they were never like thrown out in the cold.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they like did something horrible, but that was, you know, not related necessarily to the death of their son.
Okay.
But yeah, they were permitted to stay within the system, if not in the Imperial Palace, if not in Topkapı Palace, then certainly in one of the like lower ranking palaces in the provinces, Manisa, Amasya, I believe, a couple of other places. So she didn't lose, she really didn't lose that much rank, maybe a little because she didn't ascend a valley there, but she wasn't like completely demoted and ejected. It wasn't like that. Mm-hmm. But still, I mean, to see your son get strangled, you live your whole life to prepare your son for this role. And then he gets strangled by his brother in the contest. And then you're just like, that's it for you, you know?
Yeah.
So a lot of these women really lived in fear, and there was great rivalry and competition between them.
Mm-hmm. You can imagine that sometimes the politics of the harem were pretty cutthroat.
Yeah. And there was actually a notable rivalry between Hürrem and her predecessor, Mahidevran, who had been the first known consort of Suleiman. She bore him a son. What was his name? Mustafa. And he was expected to succeed his father. And then Hürrem comes along and bears his other son. And historians and media, too, have made this big deal out of the rivalry between Mahidevran and Roxolana. And historians still kind of debate about, you know, to what extent this rivalry really was that bad. I'm sure it was, but there was also a lot written about European observers, European diplomats at court, who kind of like spiced it up a little, because, you know, Orientalism is older than we think.
I mean, it seems like it would make for a good soap opera.
Right? Actually, mm-hmm. It did. There's a whole soap opera bit in Turkish based on this. Magnificent Century. Have you watched it?
No, I have not.
Oh, it's so good. Each episode is like 2.5 hours long. So it'll take up a lot of time, but it's worth watching. It's on YouTube with really bad English subtitles.
Okay.
But it's really entertaining. And I actually like the second volume of Magnificent Century even better, because it deals with Kösem Sultan, who was the penultimate Valide in this sultanate of women. And I don't know, I like it better. I think it's better done, but they're both really good. They're both on YouTube and they're both worth watching. They're educational and informative, but they're also really trashy. So they're enjoyable. Okay. And they're free to watch. So I do recommend it if you don't mind subtitles, bad ones. I have so much to say about Hürrem and the Sultanate of Women in general. I've got like 4 pages of notes here. But what I do want to talk about is what the women would go through in preparation for sleeping with the Sultan.
Okay.
Because that's more fun. So they would be taken to the hammam, the bath, they would be bathed, they would be exfoliated, so all the dead skin off, which I think anyone could enjoy. And they would have their body hair removed with this mixture of like arsenic and other pasty stuff, like a paste made of arsenic. And then it would soften the hair, like nair or veet almost.
Yeah.
And then it would be scraped from the body with like a clamshell or a mussel shell, some kind of bivalve shell. And it could easily burn if left on too long or if the concentration wasn't right. So here would be this poor girl expected to be a virgin, prepared to go visit the Sultan's bedchamber. And then she might end up covered in like blisters. So that's not going to work.
Yeah, it's very painful. Not tonight.
Yeah. Not tonight. I have a headache. And this was a big deal. She was put in beautiful, luxurious clothes and jewelry and sprayed with perfume, nice, luxurious perfume, expensive perfume. And it was this, she was expected to be like an angel on earth almost. And then some sources say that she was instructed in how to behave with him. You know, don't do anything without his permission. Don't look him directly in the eye, and then crawl to him from the bottom of the bed. So all these rules governing even her sexual behavior. These are, again, like young teenage virgins, like you're telling them all this after they've had arsenic put all over. Like, it must have been so overwhelming for these girls. Yeah. And there are some sources that talk about how they were looking forward to this. And I'm sure a lot of them did see how women could be elevated after a successful mm-hmm. night with the Sultan. So I'm sure there was some optimism about it. But even if you are super happy about it, it still sounds nerve-wracking too. Like, even mm-hmm. if you are excited, you do want to go do this, fine, but it just sounds like such an overwhelming experience, especially as a lot of these girls are probably 15, 16, 17. Yeah. Very overwhelming. That would overwhelm me now. So, I've seen the penis fish. So,
yes. You could use the penis fish as a demonstration. So, it's going to look like this. don't scream. So what does the actual letter say? Do you know who it's to or what the
It's to Suleiman. Oh. So this is a love letter that Hürrem wrote to him, probably while he was either hunting or on campaign in battle, because that's usually when she would write to him.
Oh, that's cute. That's nice.
Yeah,
that's...
and there are a number of these love letters between them preserved. And they apparently had this really like epic romance between them. Clearly, he married a slave, which he wasn't supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And they're apparently quite beautiful letters. They have been translated. I've read some of the translations. They're quite lovely. There's one in particular that I love because he's writing to her and he's complaining that she hasn't written him recently enough. So I'm like,
he missed her.
It was cute. And it was funny because I'm like rolling my eyes and I'm like the most powerful man in the world. And he's still whining about something. You don't call enough. You don't text enough. But it's cute. It's really cute. Yeah. Like the
I
most
texted
powerful man.
And you didn't text back within 2 minutes. What's wrong?
You left me on red. Yeah. So it's like on one hand, I'm like, oh, the most powerful man in the world. And he's still whining. But on the other hand, it's like the most powerful man in the world. And he's still pining, whining and pining.
Yeah.
There you go.
Whining and pining in the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah. I think that's part of our episode name. But yeah, I have so much more to say, but I don't want to have a 5-hour episode, so I suppose I'll leave it there.
Okay. So then episode names, I think Talking Skulls and Writing.
Oh, I have it. Yeah, I have it. Whining, Pining, and Divining.
That's awesome. Whining, Dining, and Whining, Pining, and Divining in the ancient world. I think that's good. That works.
Whining, Pining, and Ancient Divining.
Something along those lines. Anyway.
Something like that. Yeah.
So, Ashley, do you want to? Got any stuff in your life going on? Did you get your book?
I did, and yeah, that is what I wanted to talk about. I wanted to confirm that it is the right book. It is in excellent condition, far better than I was expecting, actually. And I have made a digitized copy of it. It is in great shape. I'm really happy to have gotten this book. So, if anyone needs a digital copy of The History of the Anonymous Storyteller or the Pseudo Shapu Bagratuni, please let me know. Or I made a public Google Drive link, so it might come up if you Google it. But if not, please reach out to me, the four of you who might need this text. I would love to share it freely. I would like as many people as possible to enjoy it. What's been going on in your life?
Nothing. I was like trying to think of something. I was looking at the Google's art and culture app that I was talking about a little while ago. And they have this little game where you take a selfie and it matches you with a piece of art. Yes.
I want to do that.
Yeah. I hope your result is better than mine.
Oh no, what was yours?
One with the most was like anonymous man, and it was a German artist. I've forgotten who it was. I was so disgusted. And it was like this older man in a large gray wig.
Oh my gosh.
And I'm like, that's what Google thinks I look like. I hate you, Google. No. You're rude.
The app is trolling. The app. I have to find out what mine's gonna be like. You're a small Victorian boy.
Yeah, so. There were a few princesses in the sort of Elizabeth I mold of like long nose, pointed chin. I didn't think they really looked like me.
But then, I can see you as an Elizabethan princess.
Then another thing that I just did before the while I was waiting for you to pop on, I was like checking out features on Zoom, and I didn't realize you can sort of add different colored lipstick, and one of the things is you can add facial hair.
Oh my gosh!
So I added a mustache and a little beard, and I looked just like my brother. It was hilarious. I didn't realize how much me and my brother look alike. But it's like he's kind of lost a lot of hair, and my hair is all sort of tied back today. But like just with the mustache and a little beard, I look just like my brother. So
that's so funny. All right, I'm gonna have to try that next time, and I'm gonna try the art app that makes me a piece of painting or whatever.
Yeah,
and see what comes up.
I'm sure you'll come up with something wonderful, pre-Raphaelite or something like that. So,
I mean, maybe, but maybe it'll be like you're a sea urchin. So I guess we'll find out.
this is Picasso. This is what you look like.
Probably.
All right, Ashley. Wonderful talking to you.
You as well. I'll see you next time.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.